We're in the middle of our chapter, The Soul and Its Liberation. The liberation of the person inside for Sri Aurobindo is not restricted to the nature of the consciousness. The essential self is a reality, conscious, powerful, in possession both of its being and of its becoming, which is issued forth. It is a manifestation of its nature. We ought not, in the fullest experience, to see an antinomy between the soul and nature, between Purusha and Prakriti. We speak in dualistic language. We use these ways to figure reality, but we ought not to be confined in mental concepts about what that is. It is our experience that leads us to the deeper understanding, to the more comprehensive vision, to something which is beyond the rationality of the mind and which rests in the reality of the Supreme Spirit. So, we'll take it up from this sentence. The cause of our world existence is not, as our present experience induces us to believe, the ego. For the ego is only a result and a circumstance of our mode of world existence. So there are a number of spiritual philosophies which induce us to think that it is the misperception of the individual gazing at reality that causes the whole thing to appear, or that this ignorance, which we call the ego, and which we separate what seems to be ourself from all the rest of nature, from what actually might be essentially, is what is at the root of the whole seeming cosmic problem. But Sri Aurobindo never loses context, and he says very clearly the ego is only a result. It is a circumstance, is not the root cause. We must get to something larger than that. This idea that the ego could be the cause of our being captured by the play of nature is itself an egoism, to think that we're at the center of all this stupendous cosmos. He continues, it is a relation, and the it here is the ego. It is a relation which the many-souled Purusha has set up between individualized minds and bodies, a relation of self-defense and mutual exclusion and aggression, in order to have among all the dependences of things in the world upon each other a possibility of independent mental and physical experience. So it's a sentence. I don't think we should lose sight of what he's actually saying here. It's subtle, but he says the many-souled Purusha. He's not talking here about the Sankhya Purusha. He is speaking here in the Vedantic context. This is a reference back to the Gita, to the larger experience where Purusha and Prakriti are at one. He is speaking of a many-souled Purusha, the Purushottama, who expresses all of these many Purushas as aspects, as portions of his own being, Ansha. And the creation of the ego, or the permission given to the ego to exist, is to begin this relationship of forces and entities so that there can be a complex and rich interplay that encourages the universal drama to go forward. We have a sense of independence. We have a sense of growing individuality because the ego masquerades as the real self. It plays an indispensable element in the cosmic play. Yes, we come to the point where we have to push it off and no longer rely upon it for individual expression. But for the moment, we can't do without it. He continues, but there can be no absolute independence upon these planes. Impersonality, which rejects all mental and physical becoming, is therefore the only possible culmination of this exclusive movement. So only can an absolutely independent self-experience be achieved. The soul, then, seems to exist absolutely, independently in itself. It is free in the sense of the Indian word, swadhina, dependent only on itself, not dependent upon God and other beings. That's a very good translation of the term, swadhina. In other words, resting in oneself. Dependent only on itself, not dependent upon God and other beings. Therefore, in this experience, God, personal self, and other beings are all denied, cast away as distinctions of the ignorance. It is the ego recognizing its own insufficiency and abolishing both itself and its contraries, that its own essential instinct of independent self-experience may be accomplished. For it finds that its effort to achieve it by relations with God and others is afflicted throughout with a sentence of illusion, vanity, and nullity. It ceases to admit them because by admitting them, it becomes dependent on them. It ceases to admit its own persistence because the persistence of ego means the admission of that which it tries to exclude as not self, of the cosmos and other beings. This is the psychological refusal to identify and claim and thus possess as witness, as real participant, all that moves around us. So this is a wholesale absorption of consciousness into itself that denies a divine, that denies a cosmos, that denies the essence of being itself. The self-annihilation of the Buddhist is in its nature absolute exclusion of all that the mental being perceives. The self-immersion of the Advaitin in his absolute being is the self-same aim, differently conceived. Both are a supreme self-assertion of the soul of its exclusive independence of Prakriti. So, in the one, it's a disidentification with the elements of nature which form the fiction of a suffering self, an ego. And with the other, it is the dissolution of that drop, that notorious drop, back into the ocean of being. And thus, nullity is achieved of this individuation in either case. One in an absence of defined being, one in the so-called an absolute being that only exists. The experience which we first arrive at by the sort of shortcut to liberation which we have described as the movement of withdrawal assists this tendency. So again, the experience is the leading element in this whole psychological process to gain freedom from identification wrongly with the externalities of nature, and carries us towards perhaps this indispensable, this often necessary withdrawal from identification, so that one simply sees as sakshi, as witness, the play of nature and no longer owns it, no longer has the sense of possession, the sense of interpenetration into it. For, he continues, it is a breaking of the ego and a rejection of the habits of the mentality we now possess. For that is subject to matter and the physical senses, and conceives of things only as forms, objects, external phenomena, and as names which we attach to those forms. Names and forms, nama, rupa, the famous pair of Indian philosophy. So this constructed entity with its many elements and relationships is not us. That's the point. We are not aware directly of the subjective life of other beings, except by analogy from our own and by inference or derivative perception based upon their external signs of speech, action, etc., which our minds translate into the terms of our own subjectivity. Ah. So, this encasement of our consciousness in the formed being of mind, life, body, the creation of the triple guna in the Sankhya philosophy, to use its terminology, doesn't permit us really to see if there is an intrapsychic reality. We think we understand what another says because we use the same language. They seem to feel that we do. So we conclude that we know their thoughts, that we have the same feelings. And often that is a mistaken attribution. We don't. Sri Aurobindo, somewhere in his letters, by the way, points out that 3/4 of the problems of human life are based upon wrong attribution, that we think we can assign a motive to a person's action when we don't know why they did what they did. They may not themselves know why they did what they did, all of us being in our externalities, tools, part of the enginery of the cosmos. We only become knowledgeable and we become masters when first we know what we are more deeply and then come back out and regain control. The control that we had up there, we must gain here too. So, when we break out from ego and physical mind into the infinity of the spirit, we still see the world and others as the mind has accustomed us to see them, as names and forms. Only in our new experience of the direct and superior reality of spirit, they lose that direct objective reality and that indirect subjective reality of their own which they had to the mind. They seem to be quite the opposite of the truer reality we now experience, our mentality, stilled and indifferent, no longer strives to know and make real to itself those intermediate terms which exist in them as in us, and the knowledge of which has for its utility to bridge over the gulf between the spiritual self and the objective phenomena of the world. We are satisfied with the blissful, infinite impersonality of a pure spiritual existence. Nothing else and nobody else any longer matters to us. So he's describing here a mental release from identity with this machinery, so that there is a kind of immersion into the spiritual reality, but one is still seeing. One still continues to be through the mental lens. That has become natural. So, what the physical senses show to us, and what the mind perceives and conceives about them, and so imperfectly and transiently delights in, seems now unreal and worthless. We are not and do not care to be in possession of the intermediate truths of being through which these things are enjoyed by the One, and possess for Him that value of His being and delight which makes, as we might say, cosmic existence a thing beautiful to Him and worth manifesting. We have gone through the divisive character of the mind back to what seems to be the transcendent, back to the absolute, the real ground of being, and we eschew all connection, all identification, all right to play in the play of the cosmos. So these intermediate ranges in which the divine expresses itself multitudinously become foreign to us, because we're content with simply falling back into silence, where all motion is the enemy. We can no longer share in God's delight in the world. On the contrary, it looks to us as if the eternal had degraded itself by admitting into the purity of its being the gross nature of matter, or had falsified the truth of its being by imagining vain names and unreal forms. So Mayavada has to throw some original error upon the only thing that exists, Brahman. So how is it that Brahman convinces the world to come into being by the cheat of Maya? How could it fall for this game? But one is left with that. Or else, if we perceive at all that delight, it is with a far-off detachment which prevents us from participating in it with any sense of an intimate possession. Or it is with an attraction to the superior delight of an absorbed and exclusive self-experience which does not allow us to stay any longer in these lower terms than we are compelled to stay by the continuance of our physical life and body. It was identified with that essence. This tick-tock, tick-tock eventually runs out of energy and time and goes away. And the spirit, ensconced in the self, remains in the self, no longer identified with this husk. But if either in the course of our yoga, or as the result of a free return of our realized self upon the world and a free repossession of its prakriti by the purusha in us, we become conscious not only of the bodies and outward self-expression of others, but intimately of their inner being, their minds, their souls, and that in them of which their own surface minds are not aware. Then we see the real being in them also, and we see them as selves of ourself and not as mere names and forms. They become to us realities of the eternal. So here, this larger spiritual experience closes this intrapsychic gulf through both an exceeding of form and name, an outreaching, which embraces all, and an inreaching, which connects to all. Our minds are no longer subject to the delusion of trivial unworthiness or the illusion of unreality. The material life loses indeed for us its old absorbing value, but finds the greater value which it has for the divine Purusha. Regarded no longer as the sole term of our becoming, but as merely having a subordinate value in relation to the higher terms of mind and spirit, it increases by that diminution instead of losing in value. We see that our material being, life, nature, are only one poise of the Purusha in relation to its Prakriti, and that their true purpose and importance can only be appreciated when they are seen not as a thing in itself, but as dependent on higher poises by which they are supported. From those superior relations they derive their meaning, and therefore, by conscious union with them, they can fulfill all their valid tendencies and aims. Life then becomes justified to us and no longer stultified by the possession of liberated self-knowledge. So Sri Aurobindo calls us beyond gross identification with this shell of being that we call ourselves typically, matter, life, mind, seemingly constructed around an ego, the Kshara Purusha, and also beyond the Akshara Purusha, which is free in the vastness of self-space, and to the origin of both, because the immobile and the mobile both come raining down as manifestation. Yes, the very essential ground of being too is an expression of the real nature, the para prakriti, the higher spiritual power of the Supreme Person, Purushottama. Para prakriti is that to which we must attain to regain sovereignty of soul over and in nature. By the way, the term stultified means to be proved to be unsound or foolish. This larger integral knowledge and freedom liberates in the end and fulfills our whole existence. When we possess it, we see why our existence moves between these three terms of God, ourselves, and the world. We no longer see them or any of them in opposition to each other, inconsistent, incompatible. Nor do we, on the other hand, regard them as terms of our ignorance, which all disappear at last into a pure, impersonal unity. We perceive their necessity as terms, rather, of our self-fulfillment, which preserve their value after liberation, or rather find then only their real value. So the three, the transcendent, the universal, the individual, don't all dissolve into one, but the universal and the individual find their real value when raised into transcendental valuation. We have no longer the experience of our existence as exclusive of the other existences, which make up, by our relations with them, our experience of the world. In this new consciousness, they are all contained in ourselves and we in them. So we identified with the transcendent, the essence of being, contain all the world in ourselves when fully we awaken, and the each sees the all, and the all sees the each, and all three terms of being are fulfilled, each in the other. The transcendence is pleased because now universe and individual are aware of him. The cosmos is pleased because each individual awakening within it is seen to be part of the transcendent whole, in the individual recognizing that the existence intended there is to express the universal within the transcendent. All of it is a rich interplay. And who is this interplay occurring within? The only one who exists. There is only one. Just that. Ekatvam, oneness, is the soul of being, is the reason why the multiplicity doesn't fly apart into disintegration. They and we are no longer so many mutually exclusive egos, each seeking its own independent fulfillment or self-transcendence, and ultimately aiming at nothing else. They are all the eternal and the self, and each secretly embraces all in itself and seeks in various ways to make that higher truth of its unity apparent and effective in its terrestrial being. Not mutual exclusiveness, but mutual inclusiveness is the divine truth of our individuality. Love, the higher law, and not an independent self-fulfillment. So the individual does not live in isolation. That's not the truth of it. But mutuality, love, the harmony of being. The Purusha, who is our real being, is always independent and master of Prakriti. And at this independence, we are rightly seeking to arrive. That is the utility of the egoistic movement and its self-transcendence. But its right fulfillment is not in making absolute the ego's principle of independent existence, but in arriving at this other highest poise of the Purusha with regard to its Prakriti. There is transcendence of nature, but also possession of nature, perfect fulfillment of our individuality, but also perfect fulfillment of our relations with the world and with others. Therefore, an individual salvation in heavens beyond, careless of the earth, is not our highest objective. The liberation and self-fulfillment of others is as much our own concern, we might almost say our divine self-interest, as our own liberation. Otherwise, our unity with others would have no effective meaning. To conquer the lures of egoistic existence in this world is our first victory over ourselves. To conquer the lure of individual happiness in heavens beyond is our second victory. To conquer the highest lure of escape from life and a self-absorbed bliss in the impersonal infinity is the last and greatest victory. Then we are rid of all individual exclusiveness and possessed of our entire spiritual freedom. So we have to step beyond worldly gratification, a heavenly abode, and laya, absorption into the supreme, leaving the cosmic dust behind us as we go. None of those work for us. The state of the liberated soul is that of the Purusha, who is forever free. Its consciousness is a transcendence and an all-comprehending unity. Its self-knowledge does not get rid of all the terms of self-knowledge, but unifies and harmonizes all things in God and in the divine nature. The intense religious ecstasy, which knows only God and ourselves and shuts out all else, is only to it an intimate experience which prepares it for sharing in the embrace of the divine love and delight around all creatures. A heavenly bliss which unites God and ourselves and the blessed, but enables us to look with a remote indifference on the unblessed and their sufferings, is not possible to the perfect soul, for these also are itself. Free individually from suffering and ignorance, it must naturally turn to draw them also towards its freedom. On the other hand, any absorption in the relations between self and others in the world to the exclusion of God in the beyond is still more impossible. And therefore, it cannot be limited by the earth and even by the highest and most altruistic relations of man with man. Its activity or its culmination is not to efface and utterly deny itself for the sake of others, but to fulfill itself in God possession, freedom, and divine bliss, that in and by its fulfillment, others too may be fulfilled. For it is in God alone, by the possession of the divine alone, that all the discords of life can be resolved, and therefore the raising of men towards the divine is in the end the one effective way of helping mankind. All the other activities and realizations of our self-experience have their use and power. But in the end, these crowded sidetracks or these lonely paths must circle round to converge into the wideness of the integral way by which the liberated soul transcends all, embraces all, and becomes the promise and the power of the fulfillment of all in their manifested being of the divine. There you are. Well, that's our place in the book. That's your place in the cosmos. And we'll take it up next time. The next chapter. Chapter 19, The Planes of Our Existence, and that will be fun. And I'll bet you know where we're going to go in Savitri then. And you probably know where we are in Savitri now. Let's continue the passages that we were reading. This is in Book 1, The Book of Beginnings. Still in Canto 4, The Secret Knowledge. We'll start on page 63. This is the knot that ties together the stars. The two who are one are the secret of all power. The two who are one are the might and right in things. His soul, silent, supports the world and her. His acts are her commandments' registers. Happy, inert, he lies beneath her feet. His breast he offers for her cosmic dance, of which our lives are the quivering theater, and none could bear but for his strength within, yet none would leave because of his delight. His works, his thoughts have been devised by her. His being is a mirror vast of hers. Active, inspired by her, he speaks and moves. His deeds obey her heart's unspoken demands. Passive, he bears the impacts of the world as if her touches shaping his soul and life. His journey through the days is her sun march. He runs upon her roads. Hers is his course. A witness and student of her joy and dole, a partner in her evil and her good, he has consented to her passionate ways. He is driven by her sweet and dreadful force. His sanctioning name initials all her works. His silence is his signature to her deeds. In the execution of her drama's scheme, in her fancies of the moment and its mood, in the march of this obvious, ordinary world where all is deep and strange to the eyes that see, and nature's common forms are marvel wets, she, through his witness sight and motion of might, unrolls the material of her cosmic act, her happenings that exalt and smite the soul, her force that moves, her powers that save and slay, her word that in the silence speaks to our hearts, her silence that transcends the summit word, her heights and depths to which our spirit moves, her events that weave the texture of our lives, and all by which we find or lose ourselves, things sweet and bitter, magnificent and mean, things terrible and beautiful and divine. Her empire in the cosmos she has built. He is governed by her subtle and mighty laws. His consciousness is a babe upon her knees, his being a field of her vast experiment. Her endless space is the playground of his thoughts. She binds to knowledge of the shape of things. She binds to knowledge of the shapes of time and the creative error of limiting mind and chance that wears the rigid face of fate, and her sport of death and pain and nescience, his changed and struggling immortality. His soul is a subtle atom in a mass, his substance a material for her works. His spirit survives amid the death of things. He climbs to eternity through being's gaps. He is carried by her from night to deathless light. This grand surrender is his free will's gift. His pure transcendent force submits to hers. In the mystery of her cosmic ignorance, in the insoluble riddle of her play, a creature made of perishable stuff, in the pattern she has set for him, he moves. He thinks with her thoughts, with her trouble, his bosom heaves. He seems the thing that she would have him seem. He is whatever her artist will can make. Namaste. Jai Ma.